Hey, everybody. Welcome to
Twin Souls Podcast with your hosts,
Jordan
and Kelsey.
BFF Fridays, where we tell you all about us and dish on our personal aspects of our lives.
We talk about the hottest topics and discuss various tough topics such as toxic parents, infertility, coming out, and much more. Stay tuned for our BFF podcast every other Friday. Welcome to episode 4 of BFF Fridays. Today we have decided to go less fun and more murder.
So this first story that I decided to choose is Natalie Wood. So Natalie Wood is a Hollywood actress from the early 1980s. So on a cool November day, on the 28th, of November 1981, 38 years ago, four adults on a boat cruise off the southwestern coast of Los Angeles in a 55-foot yacht went out and only three returned. So what happened was basically at 10 p.m., Natalie Wood, the actress, her husband Robert Wagner, and two others, including Natalie's co-star and well-known actor Christopher Walken. They all went out to Catalina Island to a restaurant called Splendor. It's been quoted by the restaurant manager that the group left and they were visibly drunken as they were leaving. So as the story goes, at 10:45, Natalie decided that she was going to go to bed. Shortly afterwards, her husband said, "You know what, I'm going to do the same thing." Apparently, upon arriving to the cabin, he found that no one was there. His wife was missing and there was a dinghy. So I guess basically like a small rescue boat.
Yep, that's what it means.
That was actually missing as well. They immediately radioed for help. And on November 29th at 7:44, Natalie's body was found floating in the ocean. She was pronounced dead and she was wearing a red down jacket and a flannel nightgown. They did find her, and she did have several bruises on her arms, legs, and her face. And at first, it was believed to be consistent with a fall overboard when she was trying to leave the dinghy, and her death was actually ruled an accident. So an interesting fact, 30 years later, in 2011, the case was actually reopened. After receiving additional information from an unknown source, the unknown source was the third friend that was actually on the boat. His name is Dennis Davern. So he was at first unidentified and then soon actually came forward and said it was me. I'm the one who came through with this extra hot information. So after investigators determined some of the bruising may have actually happened before she drowned, and now they're actually not sure and they're not consistent with her falling into the ocean. On February 1st, 2018, Robert Wagner officially was named a person of interest for her death.
Her husband?
Yes, her husband. So witnesses actually who were anchored just nearby their yacht say they heard a couple arguing loudly and a woman calling for help until about 11:30 p.m. So what witnesses state, they didn't really call the police because there was a lot of, it was Catalina Island, so there's a lot of parties, a lot of yacht parties happening, and they probably just didn't want to get involved.
Yeah, so especially if they were young kids or, you know, young adults just wanting to have a good time.
Or if they were retirees, they just didn't want to
get involved,
say anything.
Yeah,
but now these people have actually come forward and say that they have witnessed or had heard arguing, and that basically Robert Wagner was named a person of interest because Dennis Davern basically kind of backed up the story about the argument, while from what I read, Christopher Walken is like, it's, you know, slip and falls happen. She slipped and she fell. So her murder is currently unsolved.
So they do think it was a murder.
They do, yes.
By her husband.
Yes.
Wow, that blew my mind when you said that. I did not see it going there.
There was no actual evidence or anything. It's just kind of like the way everything happens. It just kind of makes sense that there was an argument before she went to bed, especially if the timeline was off. So one thing I didn't write in my notes, but I was reading that was consistent, was they didn't actually call for the rescue help until 1:30. In the morning.
Huh. That's interesting.
And they apparently all left at 10:45.
So there's a big gap there. There's a big gap. Anything could happen between 10:45 and what? 1:00?
Yeah, 1:30. 1:30 in the morning, apparently.
And they didn't call any emergency services till 1:30.
Yeah. So either the story they told was that she slipped and fell in, or there was a larger story that expanded over a 4 or 5 hour period that led up to her in the water.
Now, I'm just going to ask this because I know it doesn't say it in our notes, but was everyone accounted for? Like where everyone was or not? I'm assuming no, because the husband was number one.
Yeah, he's the one who found her regardless. So he was the one who did say that she had gone missing.
So it would make sense that if they got in an argument, maybe he put his hands on her, bruised her up. She was calling for help.
She tried getting away, slipped and fallen.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it could be anything. She was getting away from somebody.
Yes, it definitely seemed like it. Whether she was leaving herself or she was forcibly removed off the boat, something happened.
And at least two people know, the husband and the other one you said that was out with him on the boat.
Exactly.
Well, that's a really, really interesting case. I actually haven't heard about that one.
Yeah, it was a new one that I did find. Well, not a new one, an old one that I did find. I heard of the actress Natalie Wood and heard about her death vaguely. So when it popped up, I was like, yeah, let's do this.
So is that all that we're going to do for her? That's actually very interesting. I'm going to look into that later.
Yeah, that's all I have for Natalie Wood.
Okay, so number two is JonBenet Ramsey. And this case is currently unsolved. She was born on August 6th, 1990 in Atlanta, Georgia. And the night before, I believe JonBenet Ramsey was murdered on Christmas, attended a family Christmas party hosted by a friend. I'm assuming this would be the night before Christmas, but I couldn't be wrong.
Yeah, maybe, and you're right.
They go home and everyone goes to bed. And there's claims that JonBenet may have woken up and gone downstairs in the kitchen for pineapple, as it was found in her stomach as one of the last things that she had eaten. So at 5:30 a.m., I believe this was Christmas morning, I want to say, but I'll correct this later if I'm wrong.
I think that makes sense because the mom woke up early to get the presents ready.
Yeah, so I'm just going to go with it was Christmas, so December 25th. And at 5:30 a.m., Patsy Ramsey, who was JonBenet's mother, makes her coffee and discovers 2.5-page handwritten ransom note on the back stairs to the kitchen. This note read that her daughter had been kidnapped and that they would withdraw $118,000 from their account. $100,000 in $100 bills and $18,000 in $20 bills, which was the exact amount of John Ramsey's Christmas bonus that year.
Okay, so like based on that alone, it's like there's only so many people. Who's walking around saying I got a $118,000 bonus?
Exactly. I mean,
maybe to your coworkers if you're a dick.
Or your wife.
Exactly. Oh, I mean, I'd hope your wife would know. I hope that's something you'd be like, hey, but you never know.
So the cops arrived, I believe, again, this was Christmas morning, I'm pretty sure, early. And they did a search of the house, and upon opening the basement, they found JonBenet. I believe it was right off from the basement. And she was laying on her back. She looked like she was strangled, and her mouth and neck were covered in duct tape. Her father had picked up her body which disturbed the crime scene and tainting all the evidence, and brought her upstairs and laid her by the Christmas tree. Yeah. So on December 23rd, 1993, a drunken house guest called 911 inside of the Ramsey home.
So this December 23rd, maybe they had a Christmas party themselves. December 24th, they went to one. The 25th, she's found dead, and the cops had to come back. I'm assuming they came once, because you don't normally call 911 and please don't show up. They will always show up just to check. Someone called it, right?
Oh, yeah. Someone did.
So
was Christmas Day, she was killed.
Okay.
December 25th, 1996. I just want to make that clear.
Okay. Yeah, so I don't know if I really believe this drunken house guest made a call.
I don't think so either.
I think maybe it could have been a cry for help, but maybe we'll get into that later.
So January 4th, her autopsy reported that her skull was fractured, and her parents became the main players of suspicion, because obviously they were in the house with her. They knew her last whereabouts. It makes sense. So a handwriting analysis expert actually eliminated John Ramsey from the crime, but not Patsy Ramsey, who was JonBenet's mother. They think that Patsy wrote the note. And I did see that there was a handwriting sample between Patsy's letter and the letter that was found, and they actually matched. I don't know if you saw that.
I actually didn't. When I was going through, I was just skimming through to certain parts here and there, so I didn't go through and read it all in depth, because I had loaded up quite a few links to kind of try and verify some
story.
Of the information. Exactly.
So they found that it actually matched. I think it was 95% of a match.
Oh my gosh.
And that's where it ended. That's what was said. They said, you know, people are like, no, it doesn't match, but it did. There's a picture of it. I'll put that in our file on our Facebook page so everyone can see it.
Perfect.
So July 14th, 1997, JonBenet's autopsy is finally released. She was found to have been bound and strangled and had multiple abrasions, especially in her vaginal areas, and that she was struck on the head so violently to cause bleeding and an 8.5-inch fracture to her little skull.
Oh my gosh.
Which probably would have knocked her unconscious.
That's so sad. She was 6 years old. Like, I'm just innocent. Thinking about the 8.5-inch fracture.
That's big.
Like, what the hell could have caused that? Like, I mean, I guess there's quite a few things, but I mean, the force.
Oh yeah.
You're doing it with punishment in your eyes. With hate.
And no one heard her screaming?
Right?
If she wasn't knocked out?
That makes no sense to me.
So now on August 16th, 2006, ladies and gentlemen, this was years after the crime had actually occurred.
So maybe like 9-10 years, it seems.
John Mark Carr, a suspect, is arrested in Thailand. He allegedly told an American investigator he drugged and sexually assaulted JonBenet before killing her. And the DA had to drop the case because there was a lack of evidence to connect him to the actual crime scene. There was probably limited DNA, if any at all, that were his.
Well,
so they called his bluff.
Oh, I completely believe it. Basically. I mean, that's kind of weird that he would admit to something like that. I mean, whether joking
and it
or
makes
not,
sense. It makes sense that if she was knocked out and sexually assaulted while she was knocked out, maybe that's why she wasn't screaming, calling out for her parents.
Okay.
Or he knows who did it.
Right.
Just my thoughts. So on July 9th of 2009. No one in the family was considered a suspect anymore, and I believe that JonBenet's mother died before 2009, which I'm going to look up.
Yes, by cancer.
Breast cancer? I think.
I believe so.
So I think Patsy died June 24th, 2006.
Okay.
So July 9th, the family is a suspect anymore, but I think it was only because Patsy died from her cancer. That's why she wasn't considered a suspect anymore. There's nothing to work with if she's dead.
True, exactly.
Now, December 28th, 2016, a docuseries aired and suggested Burke Ramsey, who was JonBenet's brother, may have actually committed the crime. So people, I go down these holes on Reddit. People assume that when she got up to have her pineapple, Burke got upset with her for some reason, and he's the one that hit her over the head.
And do we remember how old Burke was at the time?
Burke, I think he was 8. I want to say maybe a little older. Hang on, Burke Ramsey. Crime. Burke. He was 9.
Okay.
So I was pretty close.
Never mind. I was gonna ask, is this was Burke and JonBenet the only two kids from these?
That I could have sworn I read somewhere that her father had another child from a first marriage, but I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure. So after Burke Ramsey did this interview, he filed a $250 million defamation lawsuit against the company that did the docuseries.
That seems a little excessive. I mean,
I'm assuming it's because it would have ruined his reputation if people thought that he had killed his sister, so that's why he filed. I don't know if it's worth $250 million, though.
I don't think, like, who is he? We only know about him because his sister's dead.
Exactly. He's kind of a nobody.
Like, so, maybe a million you could get away with at, like, the most, but I would think, like, $500,000.
$240 million?
So I also read something about his dad following a lawsuit as well with a civil court. About something. I don't know exactly what, because we were trying to keep this condensed, but I didn't think that was really important. I thought the $250 million was a little bit more important.
It's not really that important. I mean, there's fake all these lawsuits based on this case of whatever someone says, he sues them.
Exactly.
I mean, everyone thought Burke did it after that interview. I remember going on Facebook and watching that interview, and people are like, he was just so strange, his demeanor. And then some people had said he had autism because of the way he reacted. There was not that there's anything wrong against people with autism, really, but that was just a theory that may have been going around, that maybe he was so deprived of feelings during this interview that he had autism. Maybe that's why he couldn't show his emotions. Something like Asperger's, where they can't, you know, show emotion very well.
Okay.
So that was just some of the theories. I'm not saying I agree with it, or I'm, what do you call that? Like, stamping it in stone that's what happened. But that's just what the Reddit, trolls have been saying online, that Burke killed his sister because of jealousy.
I think there's quite a few bit of truth to all of it. I think maybe all of them, including the John Kerr from John Carr, could all be involved in it.
Yeah, like a cover-up.
I think someone had to have cleaned up, and that could have possibly been John Carr's job. Everyone else's job was to keep quiet about it. And
plus, I'm sure if Ramsey... I mean, let's just say this is a big conspiracy, right?
Yeah.
And that he did kill his daughter or set someone up to kill her or whatever, he would just easily pay someone off, because John Ramsey was well off. He could just pay someone off to be quiet.
I mean, you know, when I read the $118,000, and that's the exact of his bonus. I'm like, what you doing? How do I get that type of money? What the fuck?
Yeah, it's just, I don't know what he does. I think it's a CEO of some sort of company, but I know he's well off.
The family was well known in the area.
Oh, it says he's in business. So he's an author now as well, business person, politician, and a naval officer.
Okay.
So on January 2nd, 2019, after the interview with Burt came out, the settlement that he was asking for, the $240 million,
yep,
the judge actually dismissed it and signed the order for the defamation lawsuit. So he can't sue them again.
Oh, wow.
So the judge found that there wasn't enough sufficient evidence in this case to make a defamation lawsuit. So the evidence they brought must have been pretty weak.
Well, I think it was just when the docuseries came out, it was just offering a different perspective, because already had the perspective of the parents.
Yeah. Or like the outside people. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So I personally think it could have gone either way. I think someone could have broken in. I think the father could have done it. But I don't think Burt could have done it. In my opinion. He was 9. I don't think he would have thought to pick up something and hit her over the head and start poking around in her, you know, vaginal areas. I just don't think.
I agree.
That's what a 9-year-old would do at his age. I think he'd be more excited about Christmas being, you know, the next day and going to bed and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Which is something, oddly, that was never mentioned in that interview.
Really?
Yeah, it was very odd. It wasn't anything like, oh, I was excited to go to bed. Like, he made it very flat almost. But I think it was because, not that he didn't have any emotions, I just think because he's been talking about it for how many years now?
Well, and also thinking about it from a different perspective, his Christmas has been ruined for the rest of his life.
Exactly. That's all he's going to think about.
So regardless of what exactly happened, that story still remains a mystery and unsolved, and right?
Still unsolved. I don't even know what's on her death certificate, if it's homicide or what it says. That's actually really interesting. We should find that out.
Yes, we should. So this is the Dyatlov Pass incident. So in January of 1959, 23-year-old Igor Dyatlov led a group of young students, 7 men and 2 women, attempting to reach Mount Orotin. They were about 6 kilometers from their destination, and they were inside a forest almost a mile from the campsite. So when they were found, so none of them checked in. Everyone kind of had an idea of where they were going, so they kind of knew where to look, and this is when they had found them. So they had no skis, no shoes, no coats, and it was negative 30 degree Fahrenheit weather. So I don't know if this was American written or written in Europe. So the negative 30 degree Fahrenheit seems really cold. That's like almost negative, I think that would almost be negative like 60, negative 70 Celsius. So I think that's really high, but I could be wrong.
So this actually happened in Russia, Russia.
Yes, they were in the Russian mountains when this occurred. It was said that the area was possibly radioactive, but that wouldn't explain how they were found and anything that had happened. So let's get into some of their injuries that they were found, because there wasn't really much to go on with this. It's basically they went for a hike. And when they were mountain climbing, they stopped for the night, and next thing you know, something
never checked
happened.
In. Yeah,
exactly. So when they were found, 2 of them had skull fractures. 2 of them had major chest fractures. There was one woman who was actually missing her tongue. So basically, investigators immediately, they list the cause of death as compelling natural force. So basically they're saying a avalanche occurred and caused them to go loco and naked, basically. I mean, they didn't have any of their clothes on. They weren't naked, but they weren't dressed for the winter. So back to some of their injuries. So six of them had possibly died of hypothermia. Three additional ones had injuries. So there was two people that were found underneath a cedar tree. Their remains were next to a fire, and their hands were actually burned for some reason. There was no explanation as to why their hands were burned. I think it could have possibly been burned from frostbite, but it could have been a completely different type of burn. Burned from fire.
Yeah.
There was three others that were found in intervals of basically 100 feet, 100 feet, 100 feet. And they were all kind of coming out from the tree. The last four were found 250 feet away from the tree, and they were down in a ravine. So these four, it actually took three additional months to find these skiers. So they were found on May 4th, even though it was early January that this, early February that this hike had happened. So, like I said, the area was said to have possibly been radioactive, and some of the skiers' clothing was found to have significant levels of radiation. As well with the radiation, they noted that some of the skiers were wearing things that weren't from them. So they're possibly thinking that, so this one collapsed and died, they grabbed a sweater, they grabbed a scarf or something like that. Because a few of them were wearing something that wasn't theirs. So they were kind of confused about that. There was also no signs of struggle. No footprints of anyone other than the eight or nine people that were there, and there was no animal prints that were found in the area. According to diaries, they say that on February 2nd, that night that happened, there was a snowstorm. It is said to say that additional to all of the injuries most of them did have, the skiers' tents were also damaged as well. So it was determined upon investigating that they had been cut open from the insides. So basically, yeah, so it kind of makes no sense. So if they were in, like all of them were, so if they were all in the tents and cut open their tents, why didn't they have time to put on their gear, get suited, put on a coat, put on boots? They had no boots. Like, it kind of makes no sense.
So what, they're all just assuming now that they're all like huddling together naked in the tent?
I guess so.
That's what
it sounds
like. But
instead of the tent, they got hypothermia. And I guess basically they got like a psychotic hypothermia. They started taking off the layers.
Huh.
And then they all died. Just died. So one of the men who fled left with his camera and was found with his camera dead, but not with his gear. So I believe there was a picture or two that they were able to recover of maybe just like the camping area that they had set up the day before. I forget what kind of photos that were actually found, but this little incident, I guess you can say, caused a lot of different theories. So one theory could have been aliens, alien abduction.
I was actually going to say that.
Because... So the four that were in the ravine, their injuries were not consistent of that of a avalanche, for example. So their injuries were of like a horrific car crash, basically. That's how bad some of their injuries were. But it was only a natural force that killed them. And that's what the case was labeled as. And because thinking about Russia, like, they're not going to open it up. Like, if it is something sinister, something to do with the government and an experiment that gone wrong, they're not going to come out and tell us. They're going to cover it up and move on. So this one is actually unsolved as well.
That one is really freaking bizarre.
I think there is a couple movies out there of this that you can watch.
That is so bizarre to me. All of them had all of these injuries, and there's not one ounce of really real evidence to prove what happened.
No, there's nothing. They don't know what happened.
Aliens.
They say because the snowstorm, they got hypothermia, took their
and they went crazy.
Off, slashed. I mean, all of them. I mean, come on. There's I think 9 people.
Yeah, I don't think so. And what, that one guy had enough time to grab his camera, but not his coat?
Well, exactly.
That doesn't make any sense.
Like, to me, like, thinking that no one grabbed anything, so I'm thinking maybe there was someone outside already. So one of them was outside, possibly could have seen something, called them out and said, don't put your shit on, come outside quick, like, you don't have time. Because
that's true.
Because if one of my friends was like, oh my god, come out quick, like, as long as I'm not naked, I would quickly jump out to see what he's saying. And if it's the guy with the camera, then what was found on that camera?
If anything. But that's very interesting that he went for the camera almost like he was going to take a picture of whatever was, or whoever.
Yes, exactly. Whatever force was there.
Yeah. So that one's really interesting. I actually have never heard about that one till now. That's really cool. I mean, not in a good way, but like, it's just, it's cool.
Yeah. So the descriptions of like the injuries, I think, got a little more horrific, but Yeah, that was the gist of them.
So this one still remains unsolved, correct?
Yes, it does.
It's still a mystery, even in 2021. So the next case is Sharon Tate, and this case was indeed solved. On August 9th, 1969, Sharon Tate, a Golden Globe nominated actress, and 3 of her friends were asleep at Tate's Hollywood home, I believe.
Yes.
All 3, including the pregnant Tate, she was very pregnant. I think she was 8 months.
8 and a half months.
Were murdered viciously by 3 followers of the Manson cult. So we're talking about Charles Manson.
Yes.
His hippie cult that he kind of had going on.
The Manson family cult.
Yeah. So
what he labeled as helter skelter or something like that.
Yeah. So the instructions from Charlie to the cult members were to return Terry Melcher, Doris Day's son, home and viciously murder everyone else that was in the place. So they went in there with a job.
Yeah. They basically didn't even care if he lived there or not. That was his home, so
yeah.
go do a job, basically.
So shortly after midnight, one of them was shot, 2 were stabbed 51 and 28 times, and Tate pleaded and begged for her to stay alive to save her child. And the murderers actually stabbed her 16 times. And before leaving the house, they used Tate's blood to write pig on the front door.
So what they actually, so basically what wasn't in the notes was Tate was actually tied up to one of the other females that was there. So they were basically kind of tied together to something to the ceiling, and they were both stabbed and left there hanging together.
Oh, that's weird.
Yes. There was also a 5th person whose life was taken. I believe it was a young friend of the caretaker who lived on site. He was in his car and he was actually shot by them as they were leaving as well. So they took the lives of 4 inside and then 1 outside as well.
So the 4 murders, again, what Jordan said, took the lives of 5 that day. And this was all over Charlie Manson being rejected as a musical artist.
Yeah, apparently he was trying to get a record deal with Doris Day's son, and it didn't really happen that well. And he didn't really mention or like kind of hype up Manson or Charles Manson at all. So Manson got basically butthurt and ordered this hit.
Yeah. So all four of the cult leaders, including, I believe, Charlie Manson, they were all sentenced to death. All of them. And Charlie Manson is currently alive still and sitting in prison, and so are the other cult members. Two of the women that committed the murders actually are trying to get out of prison now. They're trying to appeal their sentence to try to get a new trial. They're saying that they were under control, it wasn't their fault, they didn't mean to do it, and they deserve a second chance. Leslie, I believe, is one of the names of the women that are trying to get out of prison.
And Leslie was the one who actually kind of opened her mouth and kind of
squawked.
Yeah, squawked on everyone else. She's laid out exactly kind of what happened.
Yeah, and she claims that she's changed person now. That was a long time ago. And that she deserves a second chance. I don't think she deserves a second chance, but she thinks. And some people do agree with her. That she was young and that she got kind of caught up in the whole cult thing.
I think these girls might have like all have been like under 16 when they got involved in the cult.
They were young.
I can kind of understand from that sense, but then at the same time, it's like, how did you not know that murder, stabbing someone, who told you that stabbing someone 17 times was good and that you wouldn't be arrested? Or
I mean, that's overkill.
Exactly.
That's killing the person, what, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times?
Yeah.
At least. So there was obviously a lot of anger behind this crime, because whenever you have a crime scene that has so many stab wounds, that means that someone was very, very angry with the person that was stabbed.
Yes,
usually,
of course.
There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of, I hate you and I want you to die.
And
they did not take any mercy on Sharon Tate, even though she was 8.5 months pregnant. They slaughtered her.
And her baby.
And her baby. Her baby didn't survive.
They took 6 lives that day. Let's be honest. Yes.
Well, she was so far along.
Yeah. Yeah. She was pleading. She said, please just let me have the baby. Just leave the baby alone, basically.
And they killed her anyway.
Yep.
Heartless. Yep. And
because she was in the house. Wrong place, wrong time.
Exactly. So that one's really, really sad. That still gets to me talking about it.
That crime is currently solved.
Yes, it is. It's currently solved, and we will upload pictures of the crime scene. You have to see it if you haven't seen them, on our Facebook page in a file specifically for this episode, so everyone can kind of see what we're talking about. Because the crime scene photos, we can't tell you how really cruel and bloody it was until you see the photos for yourself.
Exactly. And we're gonna put an advisory warning there as well.
We will.
It can be a little shocking.
Yeah. Okay, next case.
So the next case, I did not know was a murder at all, was Marvin Gaye. So Marvin Gaye is the death of one that shocked the world. So on April 1st, 1984, he was fatally shot by his father. His own father. So basically the story gets a little weird at the end. So he was shot twice following an argument after he involved in an altercation with his parents. So basically his father, I'm going to say this, but I'm not going to claim this is 100% correct, but his father was a hard drinking, cross dressing, abusive preacher.
Jeez.
That's how he was described, and apparently it was known that he was a cross dresser. So that has nothing to do with the story, but
interesting detail.
So basically, Marvin and his father got into it. Marvin was basically in his boxers and a house coat from the top of the stairs yelling down at his father that his father, if he wants to say something, he can come up and say it to his face, basically. And this kind of went on for a bit. And then Marvin Gaye Sr. came upstairs and they both got into a physical altercation. There was punching and kicking going on, which ended in Marvin Gaye's father to leave the room. He came back in, and as the wife said, as he basically walked in, he had the gun in his hand, walked in, turned, looked, shot him twice. It is said that Marvin was actually going through a tremendous internal turmoil. He was possibly depressed. He was physically, psychologically, and financially in a terrible position, apparently. So I'm thinking maybe he had a couple of good hits and then something happened. I mean, things happen all the time. So when his father shot him, his brother who lived next door came over to spend his final moments with Marvin. And he actually, I don't know how correct this is, he would be the only person to deny this or say it's correct. But he said, I've got what I wanted. I couldn't do it myself, so I made him do it.
Wow. That's deep. Holy crap.
Yeah, I had no idea about that one.
That one, I didn't either. That was new to me. I just found that out.
I think I thought Marvin Gaye was still alive. So
I thought so too. Wow, yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah, did not know that.
So did his dad face any jail time?
Yes, he did.
He did, okay. Gianni Versace, this case was solved. On the morning of July 15th, 1997, Gianni Versace woke up in his mansion located at 116 Ocean Drive. At 8:30 a.m., Gianni took a stroll down to the News Cafe, 3 miles from his home. He wore a white t-shirt, black shorts, and sandals.
Could you imagine just kind of seeing Gianni Versace and coming down
a white t-shirt,
shorts, and sandals, coming to pick up his paper, grab a coffee? But I mean,
just like casual, no big deal.
This is Hollywood. This is what they did. L.A., come on.
So, okay. It was still 9 o'clock, before 9 o'clock when he got home. His partner, D'Amico, was sipping coffee near the entrance. So Versace opened the gate, and before he could step inside, a stranger came out of nowhere, dressed in a gray t-shirt, black shorts, and a white hat. The person was also carrying a backpack and shot 2 bullets into the back of Gianni's head. And by 9:15 a.m., he was pronounced dead. And overall, it turned out that Gianni Versace was the 5th victim of a serial killer named Andrew
Cunanan.
Cunanan. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so Andrew went on a killing rampage. He killed 4 people in the span. Andrew was on a rampage killing 4 people from April 27th to May 9th. His best friend, his crush, and a 75-year-old businessman. And the crimes were called by criminologists work of a pathological, sadistic, sexual offender.
That's pretty crazy that Versace was a victim of a serial killer.
And he was here and then he was gone just like that.
Well, exactly. Exactly. It's said that Andrew Cunanan had a very high IQ. I didn't really want to get into him or his background. It was pretty much Versace got home, was shot, and that was basically the story. We did find out who it was, and he was arrested and charged.
Oh, good.
And there's also a television show, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, that you can check out as well if you want to see maybe an in-depth look that had a little more to do with his life, his lover. His lover's last. That was only his lover's last name. I didn't put the first name.
Well, no, that's fine.
Was that one solved or unsolved again?
That one was solved.
Next case we're going to do is Oscar Pictorius. Pictorius.
Asshole. Sorry.
So Oscar was a South African sprinter, and he actually became the first amputee to compete in a track event at the Olympics. So it was Valentine's Day in 2013. So he, you know, casually killed his girlfriend. He shot her to death. She had bullet wounds to the head and arm. They didn't specify how many, so I wanted to just assume one in the head, one in the arm.
Yeah.
But it could have been more. So apparently, he had mistaken her for an intruder. I thought he was in the bathroom and shot out, but apparently she was inside the bathroom in a locked door and he shot in.
Gotcha.
His neighbor, Michelle Berger, a witness, said she heard a blood-curdling scream from a woman that night, followed by a man yelling for help three times. So I want to kind of say that, like, that kind of makes a little sense. But then he was found not guilty of premeditated murder, but he was found guilty of culpable homicide and was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
He was found guilty of culpable homicide and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Is that all he got, was 5 years?
From what I read, that's what he got, 5 years.
So he should be out by now.
I think so. I think it might have just been released, possibly.
Might have been called something else. Culpable homicide means whoever causes death by doing an act with the intention of causing death or with the intention of causing bodily injury. So he was found guilty of causing her death, basically, of shooting, of intention of shooting her and kill her, in other words.
Okay.
But 5 years is a pretty light sentence, so that's surprising to me.
Right? But this is also South Africa, so their laws might be a little different.
Oh, and he's an Olympic athlete, so that probably helped too.
Ain't gonna be one again.
So this case, Nicole Brown Simpson, this was solved and unsolved.
Yeah.
I'd say, I don't want to say solved.
No, because he was acquitted for murder.
So, okay.
But, yeah. We'll get
so
there.
One popular and well-known case is Nicole Brown Simpson. Everyone knows Nicole Simpson. She was OJ's ex-wife. On June 13th, 1995, the first police officer arrived on the scene of the murder. The master bedroom was lit with candles, the tub was full, television was on, and a half-melted cup of ice cream was downstairs on the banister. And Nicole and OJ's children were asleep during this crime. So Nicole was found laying lifeless and dead on the sidewalk out of the house. She had been stabbed 12 times, and her friend, Ron Goldman, was stabbed 25 times. Her dog had been found with blood on its paws and dragging its leash. Upon news of the murder, the prime suspect was her ex-husband, O.J. Simpson. He was charged with the murders of Ron and Nicole, and on June 17th, he agreed to turn himself in. However, he got scared and he fled and led the police on a now infamous low-speed chase in his white Ford Bronco.
So this chase is still online. You can go back and check out this chase on YouTube. We're going to have to do that and maybe link it to our group or link it to our Instagram like that. But we'll try and do something about that.
Yeah, we'll link it. We'll figure it out somehow. We'll put it in the file on Facebook. He was found after the chase with his passport on him, a disguise, and $8,000 in cash. So obviously he was going to make a run for it.
Yeah, right.
So his blood was found at the murder scene. Blood, hair, and fibers of both Nicole and Ron were found in his car and at his home. One of his gloves was found at the Brown home, and bloody footprints which matched OJ were also found at the crime scene. And despite all of this evidence that pointed him to being there or around there, he was acquitted of the murders, and he later sued for $33.5 million in a civil judgment. I don't know if he won that.
I don't think so.
Did he win that?
Was he sued or he was sued for? I don't know if I wrote that. I was in a rush there.
He would have sued because it was a civil suit. It says that I can't find if he was sued, but it looks like Ron Goldman's father sued him in a civil suit.
Okay.
For a $70 million settlement, which he's still waiting to receive. Now, I believe he had to pay $33.5 million, I want to say, to Nicole's family in a civil suit. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. He was arrested and charged with B&E, as well as taking sports memorabilia that he said was his, and he was found guilty and sentenced to 33 years. He was released 9 years later in 2017. So is he out right now, or is he in?
He is out.
He's out.
So he broke and entered, was given 33 years, but he had bloody footprints. He had their blood, hair, fibers. His blood was found at the scene of the crime. Like, really? And but you're going to arrest them for 33 years for breaking and entering.
Yeah, I mean, I think he did it. I don't know if anyone else agrees with me. A thing that's long debated.
I think that 33 years could have been in regards to that, to that calling on that.
I just don't understand. He was the only one that was angry enough with Nicole and her supposed lover, Ron, to stab him 25 times.
Right? It makes the most sense. But sometimes the most sense isn't the most sense.
Well, and I just want to warn our listeners now, because we will upload the photos of this crime scene, and it's extremely bloody. So
yes, it is.
If you're not into, you know, blood and it makes you squeamish, please avoid our page when we upload the photos. That's just a disclaimer, because there will be postmortem photos on there. Do you think he did it?
Yeah. Hell yeah. He got off on murder. He totally did it, in my opinion.
I agree. I think he got away with it.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, his blood was there. Why is your blood there? Why is your blood anywhere near? I mean,
it puts him at the scene.
Yeah.
So, I don't know why.
Apparently not enough.
No, I don't know why he wasn't convicted. There wasn't enough evidence or something like that. I personally think he paid someone off, but hey.
Yeah, this sounds like it.
That's my opinion. And also, a big thing I want to mention too, not like they need any more media or attention, but the Kardashians, Kim Kardashian's father represented OJ as his defense lawyer. So that's kind of how the Kardashians started also coming up to TV.
Exactly. So he became their OJ's lawyer. And after that, they actually became friends with the families.
Best friends, actually.
Yes. Yes. So.
And Robert Kardashian swore up and down that OJ was innocent. And he got him off. So obviously he believed that he was innocent.
Exactly. Okay, this next one is the murders of Andrew and Abby Borden, also known as Lizzie Borden's story. So on August 4th, 1892, there is a heat wave going on, and Andrew and Abby Borden were brutally murdered in their home. Both had received multiple blows from a hatchet to their faces. These two were prominent members of the community. If there was anyone going or coming from their home that was fishy or that looked unfamiliar, the community would know about it, basically. Lizzie came home and she apparently discovered Andrew in a pool of blood, and he was on the couch with his face split nearly in two. Lizzie then apparently went upstairs and found her stepmother, whose head was smashed to pieces. And it also notes that the stepmother was killed first. So let's talk about Lizzie for a second. So Lizzie was 32 years old. She was living at home with her father and her stepmother. She was home during the attack, basically, as well. Lizzie claims that she was in the barn after she was arrested and charged with double homicide. At the time of the murders, so she says she was in the barn. She had no idea, didn't hear anything, and then entered the house and found her father dead. And then so the story played out. A few days before the actual murders, Lizzie apparently tried to buy poison, and that didn't really work. And then she was also noted that after the murder, she was found burning a couple of her dresses. So Lizzie was actually acquitted of murder after no blood was found on Lizzie, on any of Lizzie's belongings. And the jury was actually a jury of all males. And they see this like fragile woman who is incapable of these crimes. So basically, Lizzie's father dies and she inherits an absolutely large sum of money because her father was pretty wealthy. And after that, she moved to a new Borden house where she died in. There is a little saying, and it's Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. That is a quote because a lot of people are like, it was definitely Lizzie. She was there. there's no way that she didn't hear anything, didn't see anything. It also needs to be stated that one of the caretakers was of the house, basically, so one of the maid servants was there as well. But it was determined that because they were like basically in the attic, that was their living quarters, there was no need for them to be on the ground floors. So they were ruled out immediately. So
I still think she did it.
I think she did too. And what's kind of creepy is the Borden house now serves as a bed and breakfast.
Yeah, and people are actually all into it. They'll go and they'll stay and they want to stay right in the room, and like people are into it.
Yeah, they want to stay up all night, see if there's any ghosts that come along, wait till dark time at like 4 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
I feel like I'd be friends with those people just because that's so crazy and I love that.
Yeah, right? Like the Alma College.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, I was too scared. I sat outside with Billy.
So Lizzie and the Andrew and Abby story is currently unsolved.
So I think, I guess you could say that, because we don't really know if she did it or not.
No, we really don't. There was not enough evidence to actually state it was her.
But she was convicted.
So this next one is one I think Kelsey will find kind of pretty interesting. So this is the Beaumont Three. So the Beaumont children. So on January 26, 1966, also known as Australia Day, three children went missing. Until this day, no sign of those children were found. So the three children were Jane Beaumont, who was 9, Arna Beaumont, who was 7, and Grant, who was 4. In the 60s, Jane was responsible enough to watch her siblings, because being 9 years old, that actually wasn't unusual for the time.
Different times.
So exactly. So they had no cell phone, had no worries like we have now. So all she could do was watch her brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
So after convincing her mom, the children took a 5-minute bus ride, so a 2-mile bus trip from their home to the beach. They left at 8:45 a.m. And respected back by their mother for the noon bus or so. The children arrived at the beach. Jane was in a pink one piece with the green shorts and some sand shoes. She had 3 towels inside a bag, along with a little woman book. Erna was in another one piece. This one was red and white striped with tan shorts and sandals. Grant was wearing green and white vertically striped bathers. Underneath were green shorts and red sandals. He had no shirt on as well. So the kids had their fun at the beach, and then while the mother was waiting, 12 o'clock came around and she noticed that the children were not on the bus or got off at the stop. So she waited around for the 2 o'clock bus, and you know what? Same thing happened. Still no sign of the kids. So this is when Nancy, their mother, began to get really worried about the kids because they did not arrive home. So an hour later at 3 o'clock, still no sign of the kids because the bus runs only every 2 hours. So at 3 o'clock, their father returned home and was informed about the situation and drove to the beach to find his kids. He searched and searched and searched and came up with nothing. Could not find his children anywhere. He returned home, picked up his wife, and the two of them drove to several friends' homes to try and see if they were there, took a detour and ended up at a friend's house. By 5:30 p.m. that same day, the children were reported missing. So it's to be noted that the children had about 17 different items with them, and basically nothing was found. Not one of their pieces of items that they had at the beach with them, none of their towels, none of their extra clothing was found.
Wow.
So on January 26th, a woman mentions she spoke with 3 children who had similar descriptions. The police looked into it and they really found no leads to that. Several witnesses say they seen children. So 3 children, a boy and 2 girls, with a tall blonde man in his 30s to mid 40s, approximately 6 foot tall, clean shaven, and he was wearing Speedo type of swimmers. They were seen with this man at the Wenzel's cake shop. They were also seen with this man playing on the beach at about 11:30 in the morning. The man, sometime after 11:30, was actually seen asking people if anyone had touched their belongings because there was some money missing. So this is where the witnesses, just from all over, because they did go to the beach. A lot of people say they seen them. Some of their family friends said they seen the kids at the beach originally. So the witnesses say they seen the three children and the man go towards the chain shed. The man went inside, changed, and kids waited before turning the other way and walking towards the bus stop at about 12:15. The kids were then seen, like I said, inside Wenzel's cake shop. Inside Wenzel's, they purchased a pie, which is placed inside a separate bag, 5 pastries, 6 finger buns, along with 2 large bottles of fizzy drink. The shopkeeper knew the kids because they would come in all the time. So, I mean, they're going to know them by name, right?
Seeing them
from around the area. Yeah. So he did find it strange that the kids were given €1 exactly, as they were never given that much money ever to buy anything. It's only a few nickels and dimes because it is the 50s and you don't need anything.
Wow, that is so weird.
So to this day, there really has been not really many leads at all to this day about what's going on. This is currently an unsolved mystery. Their bodies were never found, so we never actually know if they were murdered. It was said that there was a few over the years after, a few notes being dropped off / delivered to the families.
Huh.
Yes.
Wow.
That basically looked like it was written from a young child. So they want to possibly say it could have been associated with the kids, but there's no real proof. There's no leads on it, really. So,
wow. But it was a different time back then.
Yes, it was.
Kids were allowed to do those things. They were allowed to walk to school. They were allowed to, you know, it was a different time.
Oh, right.
There were predators, but not many people knew.
Oh, exactly.
They were just trusting.
They really were.
So.
They let their, yeah, you're going to let your kids go out to the beach and have fun. That's no problem. Everyone does.
Well, especially when it's only 2 miles away from the house.
Exactly.
It's not that far.
Like, the information did go into a little bit more in depth. Like, there was some pictures I did see out there of kind of describing like A, B, C, D, kind of like where they went and what their path was and where witnesses placed them, basically.
So they were seen in the cake shop and then never seen again.
Actually, they were spotted, apparently. Not them exactly. It wasn't confirmed to be the kids, but it's always said that one boy and 2 girls were witnessed here, witnessed there. There was one witness, I believe the latest one was about 3 p.m., I believe, was the latest witness. There was one that said there was a man describing what the man who we seen on the beach, as well as a woman and another man with 3 kids, a boy and 2 girls.
Huh.
So it really is a mystery on that one.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Right? That one, like I said, is unsolved. So this next one is the murder of Roger Goodlett and the attempted murder of Tony Harris. So in the early 1990s, Indianapolis was experiencing an influx of missing gay men. So right along the Bible Belt, there seemed to have been a list growing of men who had gone missing. The list ranged from about 11 men up towards possibly 20 men.
Just tell everyone what the Bible Belt means, because they might not know.
So the Bible Belt is basically in the United States. It is the area.
They're just very conservative people.
Yeah, and it kind of like ranges from state to state. But this one goes a few states, and I believe it's somewhere in the Midwest.
I want to say or south.
I forget what the area is called, but that's basically kind of what the Bible Belt area is. Really conservative, really preachery,
religious.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So that's what the Bible Belt is for anyone that doesn't know.
There is a missing person named Roger Goodlett. He was missing, and his friends and family were desperately trying to find any connection or any. One of Roger's friends, Tony Harris, was plastering missing posters of Roger's face all in around the bar scene that they hung out at. It was one night when Tony noticed a man staring maybe a little too much at the posters. Tony, watching this man, started getting a gut feeling about this guy, and regardless of the feeling he had, he still approached the guy, even though his body kind of told him not to. So they got to talking, and the guy introduced himself as Brian Smart. They talked and talked, and eventually, and hesitantly, Tony agreed to leave with Brian to go to his house, to go swimming at his pool in the country. They left the city and drove deeper and deeper into the country. And this is where Tony started to kind of get a little bit creeped out, but nothing too much came from it. They reached Brian's place, known as Fox Hollow Farm. Brian said that the farmhouse is not his, but it belonged to his boss. Upon arriving, the men went down to the swimming pool. When they were down there, it is said that Brian possibly partaked in a little bit of cocaine because of his mood. He was a little bit different after they arrived. So they walked into the indoor pool because this guy was a millionaire. So they open the door, and the pool is actually surrounded by several mannequins, like placed in different positions all around the pool. And at first he said it was his boss that didn't like being alone, but then it said it was him who didn't like being alone. So this, I mean, Tony was still down for it. I don't know what Tony was thinking, but Tony was down, and they both engaged in some sexual activity, which one thing led to another, and Brian was erotically choking Tony. After explaining basically how to do it and how it turns him on and whatnot, he did it to Tony, to the point where Tony almost, blacked out and died, but he didn't. He let go. It was then, after kind of learning how interested and how much it kind of turned him on, that Tony was then convinced that Brian might have been the one behind these missing people. He basically called Brian out on it, and they kind of went back and forth a little bit, and Brian was cocky and maybe joking around, trying to make it seem like, yeah, it was me. Why would it be any different? Like, before Tony left, they kind of fooled around a little bit more. Brian fell asleep, passed out. And it was then Tony was like, perfect. I'll do a little scope around the house, see what I can find. So when he was scoping around the house, he came to Brian's underwear that he had placed on the ground, and he checked his pants to find the wallet. And as he placed the pants back down, Brian woke up, and Tony basically convinced him to take him back to the city. Back in the city, Tony went to the police. He did make several attempts to try and locate the property and say that possibly this Brian Smart guy was the one behind it. Like, he definitely tried to kill me the other day. He said it was me. Whether he was joking or not, he admitted it. So they kind of, any tip is a tip. So they went on it. And like I said, they did not find any connection to the property, and they did not find any Brian Smart. So it was one day, this was actually, I believe it was 2 or 3 years later, that Tony actually seen this Brian out again. He took down his license plate number this time, and brought it to the police and said, I seen the guy, here he is. The car belonged to a Herb Baumeister. So Herb is a married father with 3 kids who used his free time when his wife would go to their summer house to engage in his fantasies. So basically, the police approached Herb and asked to search the house. Herb said no. He refused. So the police went to his wife And she basically said no, and they told her that he is a suspect in homosexual homicides, and she still said no. Over the next few months, I would say, their marriage began to crumble, and after she filed for divorce, she gave consent to the property to allow them to search. The only reason she allowed them to search was because Herb, aka Brian, went on a work vacation. So when the police searched the property, this was after his son found a skull in the backyard and basically was like, oh, it's like one of those science dummies.
Yeah, it's fake. Yeah.
And said this to the son and the wife. And that's when she started questioning things. So they did find over 11 different men's bones all over the property. Panicked, and upon hearing that the police have actually searched his home, he left the country, escaped to the Pinery Provincial Park in Ontario, put a gun to his head, and shot himself. His victim total that they know of, they have named 4 out of the 11. However, they believe he has killed upwards of 27 to 50 men due to the amount of business trips and traveling between Indianapolis to Ohio. And along one of those highways, there was another 9 bodies found in ditches of men.
So they think he's connected to those bodies because he traveled.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
Yes. And so and that possibly that the timelines could have matched up.
That is very, very, very interesting. I've never even heard of this guy.
Yeah, there's a few of them out there. And wow. this was Herb Baumeister, and he was a serial killer. So basically, his crimes are solved. Yeah, solved, but unsolved.
Some, I'm sure there are some still in the woodwork that haven't been solved yet or exactly. found.
Exactly.
But the next case is on Sylvia Likens. So on October 26, 1965, Indianapolis police were called to a home where the body of a 16-year-old girl with over 150 wounds was found. Earlier that year, her and her sister Jenny went to live with Gertrude Banzweski. Over the time she stayed, Sylvia was beaten, tortured for an extended period of time by over 10 different people. This included Sylvia's own children and sons. She would encourage them to beat and torture Sylvia for hours on end. They carved slut into her stomach, and yes. She had cigarette burns all over her when she was found, and she was starved. She was very, very thin. So Gertrude ordered her kids to invite others to help with the torture of Sylvia and abuse. Sylvia was kicked in the vagina and was accused of being pregnant. I also believe that they tied her to a mattress is what I want to say in the basement.
You know what? Did tie her to a basement, and they actually forced her to shove a Coke bottle in sodom of herself.
And they also said that a neighbor named Randy forced Sylvia to eat a hot dog loaded with condiments and spices. And when she threw up, she was forced to eat her own vomit.
Sylvia was also being jumped and attacked by boyfriends of the children of her cousins. It was her cousins, right? It was a family affair.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it was family because
I thought I heard it was, but then I was reading and I didn't really specify cousins or aunt or anything like that.
I don't believe they were related because Sylvia and Jenny's father traveled in the circus. Yeah. So he was more or less looking for someone to like foster them.
Okay.
And he paid Gertrude to keep the girls. And I guess what happened was when he started to miss payments and stop sending her money to help take care of the girls, this is when she started to take it out on Sylvia and tortured her. So Gertrude Banzweski, she looks like just a piece of peach pie. So she was convicted of prolonged torture, mutilation, and eventual murder of Sylvia Likens. And they call her the torture mother. Okay, so Gertrude was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, and she was resentenced to 18 years to life She was released on December 4th, 1985, and died on June 16th, 1990.
Okay. I also seen a picture of one of her daughter's mugshots, and she was smiling in it. I was like, oh no. A big smirk on her face. I was like, that bitch.
Yeah, I don't think they had much sympathy for her.
Okay, so this one's got a little bit of a mystery as well. So this is the Somerton Man. So on November 30th, 1948, jeweler John Bain Lyons and his wife went for a walk on Somerton Beach. This Somerton Beach was also near in Australia. Is Australia, the same area. I would say maybe about an hour from where those three children went missing from. Somerton Beach. They noticed a man was dressed very nicely, and he was kind of laying on the sand with his head kind of propped up against the seawall. His legs were outstretched and his feet were kind of crossed. The couple watched as they walked by, and the man extended his arms upwards and kind of let it fall back to the ground like he was drunkenly trying to smoke, you know?
Yeah.
So about an hour later, the man was still in the same position, and when they walked by again, they noticed he had very nice shoes, but was motionless. So they were like, oh, he's just fallen asleep. I don't know how he could fall asleep with that many mosquitoes around him, but whatever. So the next morning, John went for a walk, actually a morning swim, and when he was coming back from the swim, he noticed a group of people over by the same seawall, and he walked over to find the man. In the same position, he was cold, dead, with a half-smoked cigarette that looked like it had fallen from his mouth, and it was on his collar this time. The cause of death was labeled as a heart failure, basically with the possibility of being poisoned. They went back and forth on what possible poisons it could be. It was some that I've never heard of, and I didn't really want to search to find out what they even were. So when they found the man, the contents of the man's pockets were spread on the table. He had tickets from Adelaide to the beach, a pack of chewing gum, some matches, two combs, a pack of Army Club cigarettes containing seven cigarettes of another brand, Kensitas. There was no wallet, no cash, no ID. None of the man's clothes actually had any tags or name tags on them. There was one maker's label, but that was actually carefully snipped away. There was one trouser pocket that had actually been repaired with a different type of orange thread. They did their investigations, and they took hours and hours and hours, and they came up with nothing. They had a lot of people in the community who said possibly they could know who he looks like from the picture, but when they came down to look at him, they had no idea who he was. To this day, about 60 years later, it still remains a mystery on who is the Somerton Man.
Oh, they still don't know?
Nope.
Wow, so it's still going on, even after all these years.
Exactly. So basically, there's two, probably multiple cases in the area in Australia that this is happening in.
You know, I keep wondering something when you said this. Yep. I wonder what they would do if they got his DNA and ran it through one of those genealogy sites like today to see who he was related to see if they could put a name to the face.
I wonder. That would be interesting.
That would be super interesting.
Yeah, I'm surprised they haven't. If they haven't already thought of it, that would be something that.
I mean, they could find out who he was related to, who he was.
As long as someone in his family line down line somewhere has submitted their stuff as well, right?
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't have to. It can be an eighth, ninth cousin. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
That's how they found the Golden State Killer.
Yes.
Which probably wouldn't have been a good case for this episode. But the Golden State Killer, if anyone doesn't know, he basically went on this rampage murdering all kinds of women, raping them, breaking into their homes, causing all kinds of crap for everybody. And I believe it was his cousin or a nephew, grandson, something along those lines, uploaded their DNA to a genealogy website, which led the police to Joseph D'Angelo, who is the Golden State Killer. And he was just arrested, I think maybe 3 years ago, two, 3 years ago, after going on years of a murderous raping rampage.
I want to think maybe it's less than 3 years.
I want to say less.
I want to say maybe it's in the last like 2 years, maybe a year and a half or so.
Because they're still going over all of his crimes and his statements. It's very fresh.
We could have also done the BTK killer, so the bind, torture, kill killer. So we'd, you know, break what? In.
We have to do an episode on Dennis Rader because he is very interesting.
Yeah.
His brain, he describes how he thought of his victims as objects.
Right.
So he's very kind of deluded. We have to go into that. A separate episode, but we definitely will, because he interests me.
So there's a movie that you need to check out. I just watched it the other day. It is The Clove Hitch Killer. I don't know if you've seen that one yet.
I haven't
heard of it.
So this
kid basically sneaks out to meet this girl one day, and when they're about to kiss or whatnot, and he's about to like lean the seat back for her, she pulls out a picture of a woman bound, some porno of a porno magazine of a woman bound, and the girl kind of freaks out on this kid who's like 16 years old. So she ends up telling the whole school basically, and they're really Boy Scouts and stuff like that, really religious and stuff.
Gotcha.
Goes to find out the father has secret stashes of IDs of missing women. And there's pictures of a woman, a Polaroid picture that has something written on it, like Lucky's favorite or something like that. And then it kind of gets really wild from there. It ends up turning out.
I have kids to watch this.
Yeah, it's really good. Really good. It kind of throws you off the loop. You're like, oh, what's going to happen? The ending, I wanted a little more, just a little more, but it was good. It was really good. I definitely recommend it. It surprised me.
So
Chris was like, you guys have to. He's like, oh, you should do this case, and I was like, I don't think that's a true story.
But if it is,
I'll definitely bring it up.
Thank you for listening to this episode of BFF Fridays on Twin Souls Podcast. Stay tuned for more BFF Friday episodes and more murder, mystery, and mayhem.